From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Just a few months ago, media pundits were predicting that former Vice President Joe Biden was a shoo-in for the Democratic presidential nomination. Biden was polling higher than other candidates and promised to save the nation's soul, wooing voters with the idea of electability in the November face-off against President Donald Trump. But by February 2020, Biden's numbers dropped precipitously, pushing him down to fourth place in the nation's first primary in Iowa and showing similar numbers in national polls. My guest, Branko Marchtich, calls Biden yesterday's man in a new book. That title could not be more prescient. Branko Marchtich is a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and a 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. The full title of his new book is Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Welcome to the program, Branko.
Thanks for having me on.
So what do you mean by yesterday's man? Biden is still around. He's not someone, you know, he's still polling at us, you know, although much smaller, still not insignificant level in national polls.
Yeah, and I think he's still looking good in South Carolina. So I think he's definitely going to be in the race for a while. And, you know, I think the book, one of the values of the book and why people should look at it is exactly why if Biden does stick around to the end, if he does have the chance of maybe being picked by superdelegates in a brokered convention to be the nominee, why that would not be a great set of circumstances. Basically, with this book, I tried to do two things. One, I tried to really go through the full history of Joe Biden's political career and kind of show why he would be the perfect foil for Trump in a general election campaign. And the other thing I tried to do is really try and understand Joe Biden, you know, where he got his politics from, where his particular political beliefs emerged from, and why he has them, and why he is a politician that we see today. And so I the book looks a little bit at his early life when he was a child in Delaware and how that influences politics. But it also looks at his first Senate campaign in 1972 and his first re-election campaign in 1978, and how those shaped the politics that he really was kind of the carrying the banner for in the Democratic Party throughout the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, and which is also talked about in detail, and showing how the Democratic Party as it is today, which is a much more centrist, much more conservative party than it was, at least when it comes to economic issues, than it was from the sort of New Deal period from the 30s to the late 70s. That Biden really was both the kind of symbol of this different direction of the Democratic Party, which we still see today, but also how he helped shift the party into that direction as well.
Now, you discuss at length his evolution and his positioning in the 90s as a classic neoliberal. Tell us what you mean. First of all, remind our audience of the word neoliberal. It's not something that we hear as much as we used to say even 10 years ago. Why Biden is neoliberal and what that actually meant in terms of his policies as a lawmaker.
I would say neoliberal, probably the easiest way to describe it, is a set of politics and even an intellectual framework that puts business interests at the center of politics and society. You know, things like the free market, less regulation, all that kind of thing. And this idea really comes around in the 80s, where you see the, you know, capitalism comes into crisis. Through the 70s, you have this the oil shocks and the U.S. you know, terrible inflation, and there's several recessions. And neoliberalism is kind of a response to this in the 80s. You see it not just in the U.S. in the 80s, embodied in a figure like Reagan, but also in figures like Margaret Thatcher in the U.K. and actually my native country, a prime minister called David Lange, who really began the neoliberal reforms there in New Zealand. And there's similar figures like this all over the world. And Joe Biden was at the time, you know, right now when people say the word neoliberal, it sort of has this very negative connotation and people kind of run away from it. People, you know, deny that they're neoliberals. They'll say that, you know, neoliberal doesn't mean anything, that's overused. And I would agree that it probably is overused. But it does definitely have a meaning. And in the 80s, people used that term very freely to describe political figures like Biden, who were calling for a very different direction in the Democratic Party. They were calling for it to be more along the lines of what Reagan was calling for. So, you know, balanced budgets, deficit cutting, lower taxes, less regulation, less or smaller government in general. And Biden really throughout the 80s, as I detail in the book, he's touring with this body called the DLC, which is was chaired by Clinton, Bill Clinton eventually, and was sort of this, I guess, vanguard group that tried to push the Democratic Party throughout the 80s and the 90s into a more conservative, business-friendly direction. Of course, it was corporate funded. He tours through the 80s with the DLC, lecturing Democrats throughout the country, particularly in the South, telling Democrats, we have to change, we have to become a more centrist party, we have to take on more of Ronald Reagan's politics. And through the 90s, of course, Bill Clinton comes to power, obviously, and Biden, you know, this is for Biden very good because Bill Clinton's politics, which are also similarly neoliberal, are very much in line with him. And you see things like welfare reform and, you know, the crime bill and all manner of other things. NAFTA, for example, a lot of things that, as I argue in the book, over time, hollowed out the Democratic Party's working class base, really turned people against the party, disillusioned a lot of people from politics, and ultimately led to the rise of Trump in 2016.
So the campaign that Biden has run for president this time, because he's run for president before, is attempting to cast himself as the alternative to Trump based on the years that he served as vice president under Obama. And presumably that's because a lot of people are, you know, wishing for the good old days of Obama, which in comparison to the last 3.5 years do seem like a much, much better alternative. But it's his more than 35 years in the Senate, I imagine, that you focus on in your book to point out what kind of a president he would be, right? Why are those years more critical to the formation of who Biden might be as a president than his 8 years serving as Obama's vice president?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would say definitely his years under Obama will also give you a clue potentially about what he would do as president. But you are right. I locate a key turning point in Biden's political career in 1978, his re-election, his first re-election. He obviously wins in 72 as a 29-year-old insurgent candidate. Not much, if anything, has been written about this campaign, but if you go back and look at it, it's very interesting. Biden, it's a very polar opposite campaign of the kind of thing he's running now. He was supported by youthful volunteers, an army of very young people who are very excited about his candidacy. He ran on a kind of anti-war platform, not initially, but eventually he was quite stridently against the Vietnam War and calling for withdrawal of troops. And perhaps the most interesting thing is he has this this much more economically populist platform. You know, a lot of these quotes from that campaign, he sounds like Bernie Sanders today. He's talking about how the parties were controlled by big money, how he wants to increase Social Security benefits, how he, you know, he believes the middle class is under attack from millionaires who don't pay taxes and billion-dollar corporations, all this kind of thing. 78, he changes, and I argue it's because of a challenge from the right. So he gets a pushback from anti-busing campaigners who, even though Biden is not very vocally pro-busing, they believe that he's not anti-busing enough. And they really start going after him. He fears a Republican, a right-wing Republican challenge on busing, and he also fears with 78. You see the taxpayer rebellion. Proposition 13 passes in California. There's this huge anti-tax feeling that starts sweeping the country. Biden kind of sees the politics turning. He sees the right becoming ascendant in U.S. politics, and he, in that campaign, alongside his change on busing, he also changes on economics, and he starts saying we need to cut government, cut taxes, all this kind of thing. And that really sets the pattern for the rest of his career, where whenever challenged by the right, Biden's instinct, his political instinct, is to always try and mollify, you know, whatever conservative is running against him, or you know, happens to be in power, challenging the Democrats by sort of moving towards their position and trying to co-opt their positions for Democrats becoming a Republican light.
Even during his current campaign, he's made statements saying things like he might consider having a Republican run as his running mate if he were to be the nominee, which, given this current political climate, is just, you know, and the level of political polarization that the Republicans have, you know, ushered in, just seems a statement that's quite out of touch.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I think the other element of that is that the Republican Party of today, it's a very different party from you know, during, for example, the New Deal years in the 20th century, early mid-20th century. And even, you know, if you go back to even the 70s and 80s, the Republican Party right now is, if you look at the whole world, it's probably the most radically right-wing major party on earth, certainly the only one that has the degree of power that it has. And I mean, it's not, you know, this isn't just me saying it. There were two respected political scientists back in 2012, I believe, who said this. One of them, Norman Ornstein, is actually a conservative himself. And, you know, they point out that the Republican Party has really, in recent years, particularly ramping up under Obama, kind of rejected facts and science and compromise and all this kind of thing, and really shifted way to the right. And unfortunately, the product of that is that the Democrats, instead of putting an alternative vision, the kind of vision that I would argue, you know, Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are kind of putting forward, the Democrats, their strategy has really been to present themselves as kind of a softer version of this, and to move closer, as the Republican Party inches right, to kind of move in their direction more and more. And the danger of that is, as the Republican Party becomes more and more extreme, as we see under Trump, and you know, it's unrealistic to believe that Trump is as bad as it's going to get. There may well be, and I'm sure there are, people looking at how Trump won in 2016 and saying, well, you know, I can take this strategy and I can do it better. And there's a real danger that, you know, continuing to just sort of try and combat the right and the Republican Party by mollifying them, it will only embolden them, as it has for the past few decades, and lead to even more extreme direction in U.S. politics.
Let me ask you, Branko, to tell me a little bit about some of the personal tragedies that Biden has faced that have affected or impacted himself as a politician or not, because the mainstream media has drawn attention to, you know, the fact that he's lost multiple family members. He's a very human figure, but have those tragedies actually shaped him as a politician?
I don't know if they really have. You're right that he's a very tragic figure. Obviously, his first wife and infant daughter were killed in a car crash. His two sons very nearly died in that same car crash. Pretty much, you know, a few months after he was first elected to the Senate, you had, you know, obviously in 2015, his son, by then a grown man, died of cancer. So there's constant tragedy in his life, and it does make him a very sympathetic figure. And you see Biden, he does use those stories as a way to connect with people, to connect with people's grief. Whether it's shaped his politics, I honestly haven't really seen it. I mean, there was Biden actually ran an ad last year, basically kind of implying that a single-payer healthcare system would have made his deceased son's kind of medical ordeal a lot worse,
which was quite shocking.
Quite shocking. It's particularly because you know, there was a report that back in 2015 or 2016, I can't remember exactly which year, when his son was going through this ordeal, that Obama actually offered to lend Biden money because obviously the medical costs were going to be so high and prohibitive, he didn't want Biden to end up in a financially distressed position. So Obama actually offered to lend him money to help him, which of course he wouldn't have had to do under a single payer system. So whether it's shaped his politics, I honestly have not seen that it has. It's obviously a kind of thing he taps into to be able to try and connect with people.
So on this issue of policies that he has been associated with, that he has tried to disavow, how seriously do you take him? One is immigration. He has recently come out and said that he thought that under the Obama administration there were too many deportations. There's the crime bill that he really led the charge on in the 90s. Then there's his vote on the Iraq war, which was more than just a vote. He also led on that. That's the foreign policy aspect of it. So he's sort of today maybe trying to adjust himself to primary election voters and seeing a different reality, has attempted to either rewrite his history or apologize for those past policies. Is he a changed man on these issues?
I think on some issues, the criminal justice stuff, for example, a lot of people have shifted on that. Even, Sanders voted for that crime bill, and he said, recently and in years previous that it was a regret, that he wished he hadn't done it. And Biden has sort of, he said some of the things in the mid-2000s, once the political winds shifted. But I think also, once there was kind of a different... there was more alarm over the results of these policies, and we saw the ultimate consequence of them. He does seem to have changed on that. On other things, I mean, the immigration issue, I'm glad you bring that up, because it's not just under Obama. Biden throughout the 90s, and this is covered briefly in the book, but I urge people to look up a piece I wrote about this back in 2018, I think, called Joe Biden, the Anti-Immigration Enabler, for Jacobin Magazine. Biden throughout the 90s, along with a lot of Democrats, he was not alone, voted for a slew of bills that ended up passing into law that created the kind of deportation powers that Trump and Obama used. And in fact, not only that, but he led the Plan Colombia, which it was a way to stop immigration from Central America going into the U.S., but actually hastened it by giving... funneling money to abusive security forces in those countries and mandating economic policies that made it harder for people and made people more likely to immigrate, really led to the immigration crisis of the 2000s and the 2010s. On other stuff, the Iraq war, I'm sure Biden does regret that vote and his role in really leading the charge for the Iraq war. But his attempts to, unlike the criminal justice stuff, he hasn't apologized and kind of disavowed that stuff. He's been really outright lying about his record, saying that, I didn't really support the Iraq war. I only voted for this just because I thought Bush needed the leverage to do this. And also, as soon as the Iraq war started, I was firmly opposed to it, which is not true. And there have been multiple fact checkers, not just me, but CNN and I think the New York Times and PolitiFact and others who have pointed out that this is not true. And we saw a similar thing with the kind of the stoosh of Social Security benefits and Medicare. Biden saying that he never tried, he didn't really try and cut it. It's not true to emphasize that he has this decades-long record of trying to cut these things. Which again, it is an outright lie. There's no way that the campaign doesn't know that the campaigner himself does not know his own history. And you can look in the book, and several, The Intercept covered this pretty well as well. There's a long documented record of Biden calling for cuts to these programs and coming perilously close to putting them in danger, perhaps most notably by voting for the balanced budget amendment during the 90s, three separate times. Each time it fell one or two votes short of actually passing and potentially going the next step to becoming a constitutional amendment.
One wonders if greater media coverage over the past few months of the reality of Biden's record is what has led to his fall in poll numbers. I'm also wondering if you have an opinion on why former President Obama has not endorsed Biden. One would imagine that he would endorse the person that was by his side for for 8 years of his presidency. Unless there's something that Obama worries about Biden that we don't know.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's well documented at this point that Obama did not want Biden to run for office. I think there are several reasons for this. I mean, I think we're seeing right now, people don't want to talk about it, but Biden really has lost a step. He's not as quick-witted and sharp and eloquent as he was even 4 years ago, let alone 8 years ago.
He's also had inappropriate behavior toward women.
Yep, exactly. There's a lot of things about Biden's record that people didn't know about and still don't know about. They don't know the full extent of just how opposed he is to the direction of the Democratic Party, the way it's going now. And I think for Obama, we've seen Biden wrap himself up in Obama and all these debates and even outside debates, he's run ads that kind of imply incorrectly that Obama has endorsed him. And I think for Obama cares deeply about his own legacy. And we've already seen how in these debates, in several of these debates, attacks on Biden have sort of been an attack on the Obama administration by proxy, on Obama's record on immigration, Obama's record on trying to cut Social Security and Medicare and a host of other things. So I think Obama was worried that Biden running would hurt his legacy. It would engender a reappraisal of his legacy and what those 8 years meant. And I think, he was probably right, because I think people are looking at the Obama years, they're looking at Biden's role and what he did during those years, and they're saying, well, hold on, this is really not what the Democratic Party should be doing.
Right. Well, Branko, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out the website for Jacobin, where you are a writer.
It's jacobinmag.com. So jacobinmag.com. And you can find, I have a series of articles on Joe Biden that I wrote for Jacobin in 2018, some of which is in the book, some of which isn't. So people may find that interesting.
And the name of the book is Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Branko, thanks so much for joining us and good luck.
Yeah, great to be with you.
My guest is Branko Marchtich. He is a staff writer for Jacobin magazine and the 2019-2020 Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.